The PSNI has just announced that dissident Republicans have indeed obtained the data set containing the names, rank and postings of every police officer in Northern Ireland. This is a major security problem in the making. I'm joined by Roy McComb, an old friend of the podcast, who is a retired Detective Chief Superintendent. Roy was also Deputy Director of Britain's National Crime Agency. I'm John Mooney and welcome to this edition of The Dark State. If you need to contact me, please do so using the Signal app at +353 89 975 3779. And thanks to everyone who is financially supporting the show on Patreon and Apple Podcasts. Roy, could you please give me your assessment of this very fast moving story?
Well, for context, John, as your listeners will know, the PSNI had a data breach last week that constituted the entire workforce name, rank, serial number, location, effectively. No home addresses, thankfully. And all of that was put onto a public forum for a period of around 2.5 to 3 hours last Tuesday. We now have a confirmation today of what I think everybody was expecting, that the information is in the hands of dissident Republicans. A statement, a very frank statement issued this afternoon by the Chief Constable to say that that information is now confirmed to be in the hands of dissident Republicans, which as a very quick response clearly indicates an increased level of risk to those members of the police service, both police officers and police staff.
So we discussed this at the weekend in about what could actually happen and how this information could be used. And you and I had various thoughts on this. It doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to have their homes shut up or they'll be subjected to assassination attempts or anything like that. What you may see is all sorts of other types of intimidation and problems arising, such as the names of officers being painted on gable walls. There are officers who are on secondment to the British Security Service. They may have their names plastered all, you know, across on graffiti across various places. They are the most obvious issues that you and I would think about, but there are lots of ingenious ways to use data like this. Roy, would you talk the listeners through your views on this and what you think is likely to happen next?
Well, I absolutely agree in that first point, John. The fact is today in West Belfast, we have a senior member of Sinn Féin having his photograph pasted across a wall opposite the Sinn Féin Advice Centre with a series of pages from this data set and the rather threatening term saying, Jerry, and it was Jerry Kelly, Jerry, we know who your friends are. So, you know, and a very simple act of printing off a number of pages from this data set and putting it on a gable wall creates immediately that sense of, well, what does this now mean on this occasion to those officers that may be identified, but also to the likes of Jerry Kelly? So, I mean, that's a very low level action that someone can take in the dead of night with, you know, a little bit of wallpaper paste, and 5 minutes later it's up on a wall. You could amplify that across the whole of Northern Ireland by saying, here are the lists of names of people that we now know to be serving members of the PSNI. And you could write up their names, you know, name, rank, serial number, working at whatever department. And the mere fact of that being publicly set out for people driving past and walking past simply increases the level of risk and exposure to those officers. And it will automatically generate an internal sense of fear and concern about the safety of those officers. Now, you then go to the other extreme, John, which is, this is a data set of the entirety of the police service that was not available to dissident Republicans or anybody who wished to cause harm to the police, including sophisticated organized crime groups or even nation states. They now have all of that information in one location. So they have been given a real gift to increase their ability to do targeting and intelligence gathering. And so it doesn't take an awful lot more to suddenly start putting information that we all leave as a sort of a digital footprint around the internet to join those pieces of information up with the now public available information about the police service, and suddenly you've got a rich picture of those members of the police service that you wish to take further action against. And the combination of that information absolutely increases the level of threat and risk. Ultimately, to the point, John, that if the capability exists for Republicans to take lethal action, as we've seen happen and almost happen in February of this year in Oma, you could see police officers being targeted at the very extreme where their lives could be very significantly at risk.
But even if, I've been kind of thinking about this, that when you're dealing with data sets like this, it's possible to identify people in the strangest of ways. Like, for example, if you search through social media profiles for people with these names, you could look for, you know, who their followers or friends are. Do they match people that may be in the same unit as someone you're looking at? And you can build a lot of information about people by true open source intelligence. I think intelligence services, militaries and police forces around the world are really learning that this is as valuable and as lucrative in terms of information gathering as any other type of surveillance and intelligence gathering. It is really, really important.
Well, you're absolutely right, John. And I think about the as a really sort of sharp comparator, if you consider the Unabomber who for 16 or 18 years wreaked havoc around the United States, sending explosive devices through the mail. It took 16 years to identify him because he lived off the grid. You then compare the two people involved in the bombing at the Boston Marathon, and they were caught within 4 days. Why? Because we live in an era of digital footprints being left. And the difference between somebody being caught 16 years after their first device and 4 days was the presence of digital evidence that was being used to identify people. You mean you would need to be living in a sort of a monk-like state nowadays to not leave some type of digital footprint of your own activities around the internet for someone to spend time to identify you. And I think that's my fear, that that there may not be an immediacy of high-level activity, high-level risk activity against police officers and police staff, but there may be a long, drawn-out intelligence-gathering campaign that now sets in place where the dissidents sit down, plan how to best use this information to fullest effect. And throughout the entire period, you will have police officers living in an enhanced level of fear because they don't know whether their name is being developed for further activity or is simply in the presence of Republicans and in some sense inactive. So, you know, this isn't an unexpected development, but it simply confirms the worst fears of the police service.
And I was just thinking there, Roy, as you spoke, that this really does have a lot of implications. I'm just thinking of people that are named as agent handlers, for example. In many cases, they use false names when they're dealing with clients, so to speak. But now you would maybe have a situation where their informants actually might be working out who they're dealing with and who they are and who they work for and all that kind of stuff. Like, I mean, there are significant repercussions with all of this. And it's almost you said to me last week, it's difficult to comprehend this and to kind of imagine all the different scenarios that could be affected. And we are all struggling to comprehend this. And I can't help as well but think that if, for example, really simple form of intimidation would be to simply start taking officers assigned to specialist roles within intelligence, within surveillance, and dubbing their names across on gable walls, on building sites, whatever it is, or, you know, printing them and distributing them in communities, etc. That could be very intimidating for anyone working in that area. People who are used to living in the shadows tend to get very worked up and very scared when their names or their identities or even their roles enter. There's even the suspicion that it may enter the public domain and our court system and our police forces on both sides of the border go to enormous lengths to protect people in these roles. But that's literally, those protections have now evaporated to a degree.
Absolutely. And in a couple of clicks of a button, efforts and endeavours to protect the anonymity and the identity and the safety of people working in the police service who do not have forward-facing, public-facing roles has been taken away from them, not by the actions of malicious actors, but by their own organization. And I mean, that's a bittersweet moment. If you have spent your days protecting your identity so that you do not become at risk, in a heartbeat, your information has now been publicized and you've now been put right under the spotlight along with 10,000 other colleagues from the police service. And that's no fault of your own. So that will be, you know, an emotionally challenging position for police officers and police staff to be in, that no matter what they have done, they're suddenly part of the drama, and that will change their outlook on things. That will make them much more wary. I will say this, John. I mean, the police service in Northern Ireland, for reasons that are blindingly obvious, have had to be very resilient. They've been through considerable challenges, whether in the form of the high level of terrorism. And there's still officers serving in the police service of Northern Ireland today who will have gone through the sort of the end stages of the terrorist campaign that ended in sort of 94 to sort of 98. And there's still officers working there who will remember those really dark days. But even more recently, we're now living in a position where the level of threat is still at severe. So in essence, the operational activities of terrorist groups may not be as frequent, but the threat level is still as severe as it was 25 years ago before we started having peace accords and ceasefires and things. So, you know, you add that to what we talk about, this sort of the intent and the capability of organizations. I think the intent is identified by the security services who've said there is a severe terrorist threat in Northern Ireland. What has happened as a consequence of this leak is that inadvertently the capability of these organizations has just been enhanced, not by their own actions, not by their own endeavors, not by their supporters, but by the very actions of the police service. So, you know, this is a real gift to organizations who mean harm to police officers and police staff or the police service generally.
And it should also be stated, and I was just having thought there whilst you were talking, that if the PSNI had been actually attacked by cyber criminals or indeed a nation state actor, I don't think they would have been able to gather all of this data in the one spot and exfiltrate it. I think this is a really unique scenario, what happened, because hackers would be almost overwhelmed by data and material and wouldn't have the ability to maybe get the entire list. I accept that no one's home address is on this data set, but you can tell an awful lot by someone's name and their initials, because people leave, no matter how vigilant they are, they leave behind traces of who they are, or in many cases, it's their families and friends and network of associates that sometimes say to people, oh, he's this, you know, he is this, he's that, and everything else. So you can be identified lots of different ways, be through electricity bills. Like, it's just, the more I think about it, the more potential problems I see. Like, you know, if someone had access to a utility service or payments made to utilities, you could narrow down names quite quickly and work out who these people are if you were determined enough to do it. And that brings me on to a point that I'm really interested to hear your views on. If this has the calamitous effect on the PSNI that many people in the service seem to be suggesting it will have, and that you may see a lot of people, say, seeking compensation, feeling that they have to move home, etc., what are the financial implications for this? Because, right, lots of people listening to this show, they might not understand that police forces have budgets. I'm always astonished by this kind of misguided belief that police forces or agencies, they just unlimited budgets behind them, that they that if they need extra resources, that's not a problem. If they need surveillance teams, a helicopter will arrive and drop them off. It doesn't really work like that. And there's financial constraints on even the most high profile investigations. Would you just talk the listeners through your thoughts on this?
You're absolutely right, John. It would be amazing if the police service had this endless money making capability out the back of the headquarters that could just churn out, whether it's extra money or extra police staff as and when required. I know it always gives the impression that it is able to deal with any emerging situation, but actually on the most dramatic occasions, when the big state visits, the big emergency operations, oftentimes that stretches the organizations to almost breaking point. PSNI doesn't have the kind of strength and depth of numbers to the point that if we think back to the visit of President Biden to Ireland in the last number of months, although President Biden was in Northern Ireland only for one day, we still had, or the PSNI still had to call upon mutual aid from services in Great Britain because it couldn't deal with the particular demands of what was effectively a one-day visit. So there isn't that endless supply of resources. To give you a sense of the challenges facing this, the organization financially, they will have to now have a robust emergency response process, which has been mentioned by the Chief Constable that they have created this kind of emergency call center, advice drop-in center, however you wish to describe it. All of that will be taken away from frontline duties or will be being bolstered by some other capability. So there's an immediacy of having to find funds to provide for something that wasn't part of any planning when the police budget was being set. Then you have, 10,000 staff or officers saying, am I at risk? What are the risks to me? And I think the police service will do probably a generic risk assessment to indicate, well, what are the generic risks? But then when you get into people saying, no, that's not enough. I will need specifically a risk assessment against me because I'm in this position or that position or this role or that role. All of that will take time and resources to put together and will also call upon the services of MI5, who hold the intelligence lead for national security in Northern Ireland. So all of that's going to cost money. Then you have the currently around 2,000 members of the organization who have already lodged an indication that they want to take legal action against the police. I would anticipate that number will rise, John. Those are legal claims that have to be met. They have to be legally dealt with. That's the cost of lawyers bringing in extra, legal advice from outside the organization. There's more money. Even if those bills are settled quite quickly, each of those is going to cost several thousand pounds per officer from a budget that didn't have that figure allocated in advance. And then you get the cost of officers who may have to actually move. And part of that cost is likely to come from the police service. Maybe not the bulk of it, but some of it will still come from the police. And then you have the element of the actual breach of data, which will be investigated by the Information Commissioner for the UK, who has the ability to levy a fine up to £17.5 million on the police service. Now, that's against the context of the Chief Constable saying at the beginning of this year that he was expecting a budget deficit of £141 million, which could run out as an extra, as a reduction of 1,000 officers before we get to the end of fiscal year 2025. So 3 months ago, the Chief Constable was saying we were in dire straits. Now we have a situation where that situation has just become a perfect storm of financial difficulties that lie ahead for the police service. And what will be interesting, John, is whether and to what extent the UK Treasury is willing to lift up some of this financial burden. The risk, I think, going forward is if all of those costs are met by the police service, it's from a diminishing budget as is, that will begin to play out in the public visible policing that the citizens of Northern Ireland would expect or hope to see, and you will simply see less policing.
And you're sorry if I'm pausing every so often. It's just my mind is finding it hard to comprehend all the potential outcomes from this. But I'm also, you mentioned, Roy, that if officers were offered, you know, several thousand in compensation, I mean, I assume those who maybe came under serious threat or had their names, you know, spray painted on a wallway close to their home or in their local town or village, that they would possibly have to move home. You would probably be dealing with the potential of moving kids out of school. Like this, yeah. It just goes on and on and on. And several thousand pounds doesn't solve their problems. It really doesn't. And I know, and you'll probably agree with me this, but in Northern Ireland, there's a SPED system, and that is used for police officers who come under threat from paramilitaries and organised crime gangs, which very few people, with the exception of Roy, have mentioned in all of this. They are a major player and a major issue in terms of policing in Northern Ireland that are overlooked because terrorism is treated more seriously, but they are just as dangerous. And in many aspects, they are usually paramilitary types involved in that activity as well. But if you, when you're dealing with all of these issues and they're brought together, I mean, you're looking at a massive, massive policing problem. You're looking at huge amount of money that would be required to cover this. And then if something actually happens to an officer, like if an officer was attacked this evening, would we know whether that was inspired by this data leak, or was it something that had been planned for the last 6 months? And there's a little bit of me wondering about whether this is actually going to encourage attacks. So I do a lot of academic research and research into violent dissident Republican groups. They tend to act every so often. People often describe them as, politically motivated terrorist groups. I'm not so sure about that anymore. I think there's lots of different things going on within these groups. They're more like violent subcultures now. But I'm just wondering, and I'm really interested to hear your thoughts, Roy, in terms of, do you think this could inspire attacks, like even a rock being thrown through someone's window or their car set ablaze? It doesn't have to be a gun attack. It doesn't have to be a bomb attack. It could be just a simple act of vandalism or arson or, you know, some sort of other form of violent intimidation. What are your thoughts on that?
I think if you were in sort of the planning mode for an organization, whether it's dissident Republicans or indeed loyalists, we cannot take our eye away from loyalist paramilitaries. And then the common denominator between them is organized crime groups. So you have those three entities which are often bleeding in between each other about their loyalties. We think back to the attempted murder of John Caldwell at the beginning of this year. And as the investigation by the police has indicated, this appears to have been a combination of Republican paramilitaries and organized crime groups that have loyalist affiliations. So you have a real coming together of different forces with an intention to do harm against a common enemy in the form of a senior police officer at the time. So this is a data set that will not age quickly. It can therefore become a valuable asset to people who wish to do harm to the police service. And the simplest way of doing it is that low-level activity to simply reaffirm to people, we know who you are, we know where you work, and we are keeping an eye on you. Even if there's nothing behind the threat to substantiate that, it's the mere fact of you as a serving officer believing until this time last week that you were relatively anonymous. Suddenly that anonymity has been stripped away from you. Now, we're then expecting, as the citizens of Northern Ireland, we still expect the police to turn up and do their duty. We still expect them to deal with all of the stuff that, you know, any police service is supposed to deal with. In reality, every one of those officers, every one of those members of staff is operating against an increased level of threat. And if you put yourself in that position, can you imagine going about your daily duty on Monday of last week And then Monday of this week, your world has shifted because now everybody knows what you do and everybody knows the role that you're in and everybody has, you know, your rank and your serial number. And that just shifts the axis of what, of how you go about your job, because I don't know that anybody can be completely blasé about the point of saying, well, there's nothing new in this and I'll just carry on as if nothing has happened. Your point around the SPES scheme, which is the special purchase of evacuated dwellings, I mean, that's a huge throwback to the 1970s and 1980s in Northern Ireland, when police officers, members of the Ulster Defence Regiment, politicians, whoever it might be, came under significant threat and had to leave their homes, sometimes overnight. Now, the occasions where that has happened is probably significantly fewer now, but this data leak may ultimately see a spike of activity going forward where people are being identified to their home addresses. And if anybody has ever moved house, you will know when you'll recognize the, you know, the challenges and the kind of stress and tension that that puts you under when you're moving home under your own volition. Now, imagine it so when suddenly you're told you don't have a choice to move, you have to move and you have to move quickly. And that's, you know, you, your family, any children that you may have, any dependents who are living close to or with you are suddenly affected. That, you know, the kind of the challenge on that and the emotional, mental strain that that puts individuals under is significant. And we just don't know how many people that might affect. I mean, I've said previously, John, I don't think we see the edges of this yet. I don't know that we see where this begins to tear off and become kind of normal business at this point. I think we're still seeing a sort of a crisis response because we don't yet know the implications of this breach in all of the different formalities that we've talked about: financial, personal security, public confidence. All of those matters are feeding into a kind of a perfect storm of concern about the ability of the police service to go forward. And I do reiterate that the police service is largely a very resilient organization. I don't expect there to be people retiring, resigning at volume. I think there will not be that type of activity at this point. That, of course, may change, but certainly at this point, I don't think that there'll be a mass walkout from the organization. But, you know, I have huge sympathies for those members, those former colleagues who are now facing just an enhanced level of threat at this time, John.
It's just on the relocation scheme. The reason why I raised that was because there's not a lot of people are permitted to enter that scheme these days. But of those who do, it doesn't operate very simply. This is left to the Northern Ireland office. There's huge delays in trying to arrange some of these packages whereby people are provided with compensation to move. And there's all sorts of issues arise. And I remember a couple of years ago interviewing one man who actually lived in Cavan and had received threats because he lived in Cavan and in obviously in the Republic, but worked as a PSNI officer and found himself in this no man's land where he had to leave his home. But because his property was located in the Republic or south of the border, that he wasn't entitled to the compensation from the Northern Ireland office. Yeah. And there were horror stories of people who had entered that scheme and ended up in this very, very precarious financial position as a result of their commitment to serving the people of Northern Ireland as police officers. And the other matter about this is that, and I think this is, we're kind of hinting at it, is that the psychological impact of this on police officers and families and having to undergo or enter into a system like that, it is phenomenal. It's marriage ending. It is the stuff of nightmares and trying to raise kids, to have to move them at speed from their schools, away from friends, etc. It's a very, very difficult situation. And when you start thinking about that, it's one of these issues. It's so big, it's hard to contemplate. If it's one or two people, you can kind of come up with figures on how much might be involved and, you know, the type of issues that they'll face. But when it's potentially thousands of people, it's almost unimaginable. And again, Roy will know this much better than I do, but Officers who move positions within police forces in very small numbers usually cause lots of problems, because you have people joining units that may be unfamiliar with the type of crime that they're dealing with, or they're in a specialist unit. You can't just pop people into those jobs without backgrounds and training and history and a feel for it. So there are very real problems with this in terms of delivering normal policing services.
Yeah, I mean, in effect, John, there's been now a significant rupture in business as usual in policing, because this isn't you know, all of the things we're talking about, where, you know, the police will have to do risk assessments and consider the threats against officers. This work is being done by people who are themselves the subject of this. So this isn't being done by a distinct body of officers and staff on behalf of those few people that are affected by this leak. All of this work and research and welfare advice, all of this is being done by people who are themselves involved in this leak. And that's an exceptionally unusual state of affairs to be in. I just think that there's a rupture in how policing will be able to carry on. It will be unrecognizable, maybe not to the public, but, you know, if you're behind the scenes, and I had a conversation with a colleague today, you know, who was, you know, fairly not blasé about the whole matter, but he was, you know, accepting the fact that it had all got a little bit more complicated over the last week. But what he was saying is, you know, the organization is really beginning to feel the pressure about the enormity of what has to be done to try to right the ship. And, you know, I sort of made the point, I don't mean this to be flippant, John, but this is sort of like an Apollo 13 moment, where the, you know, the risks of the organization spinning off into space because it just simply cannot cope are very real. Or it could be, you know, NASA's finest moment, where the organization gets a grip on this, quickly starts putting measures in place to provide reassurance to its staff and to the public and to government and to its partner agencies, can begin to plug any potential leaks, can begin to pick up anybody who means harm against any of its officers or staff, and can show real leadership to the point that as quickly as is possible, organization can get back to a degree of normality and a degree of status quo. Now, how quickly that can be done, I think, is going to be the leadership test facing Simon Byrne as the Chief Constable and his senior leadership team. And I sincerely hope he's getting all the support he can, because the chief's job is a lonely job at the best of times, but this must feel a particularly difficult one right now.
I couldn't agree with you more. He seems to be quite stoic. I was watching his press conference today, and he seems to be very calm and measured. I don't get a sense that they're trying to conceal anything. I think they're saying, and they're giving updates on what's happening as it happens, which is kind of refreshing. And I know over the weekend, as a journalist dealing with all of this, I found the PSNI relatively straightforward to deal with, and were very upfront about what was going on, which is a good thing. And that's right and proper that they handle it like that, because when official agencies and policing agencies start to try to conceal or downplay issues like this, it actually is counterproductive and it makes it 10 times worse. Yeah. Finally, Roy, the dissidents have certain capabilities, but they're very careful not to engage in too many actions that kind of provoke a very strong response. So, you know, the kind of terrorist actions that they engage in tend to be only a small percentage of their day-to-day activity, which is usually targeting people, resolving disputes in their own communities, you know, intimidating drug dealers, that kind of stuff. And that goes on both sides of the border. That's not a phenomenon that's only happening in Northern Ireland. And loyalists, as we know, some of these organizations are very much involved in the drugs trade and extortion and real hardcore types of criminal activity. So the one thing about these groups, and I don't know whether you'll agree with me, is that they tend not to behave in a predictable way. Sometimes they do, but most of the time they've kind of got into this mindset of taking their time. You know, they've changed a lot of their modus operandi and the way they carry out attacks. And they tend to, in recent years anyway, be a little bit more selective and less inclined to, you know, use car bomb attacks, possibly because they haven't got the expertise to make them, or they live in a different world where they can be caught more easy than they would have in bygone years. But I'm just wondering what you think will happen. Do they need to do anything? I mean, this is the classic bogeyman story whereby the chief constable proclaims that they have this data set, and he believes it's in the hands of dissident Republicans. So they don't really need to do anything to instill fear in anyone, because if you're a police officer, or your husband or your wife is a police officer, you've heard enough. You're worried. Do you have any thoughts on what, you know, in reality, what is likely to do, and the psychological effects that this will have on the PSNI?
I think the sort of cautious approach that you've outlined, John, may continue in the short term. They may be cautious because the recent experiences of being a member of some of these dissident groups has not been a positive one. Their ability to perform what they may call successful terrorist activities has been very heavily sedated by the activities of the intelligence agencies, both north and south of the border, and also law enforcement as well. So they have been operating, I think, in a measure of paranoia, not knowing whether any of their own brethren, as it were, are loyal to their own cause. So, you know, they have been cautious to make sure that they don't have any informers within their ranks, and they have operational security. But of course, one of the pieces of work that they would have been doing and would have continued at a measured pace was intelligence gathering. And I think what this has done is simply to feed the fire with a little bit more oxygen, a little bit more fuel, and has made their job an awful lot easier going forward, because they don't have to invest time and effort to try to identify Officer A or Officer B, because that's just been done for them. Mm-hmm. And suddenly they have a list of people. And those that are probably, I don't want to elevate any of their activities because, you know, I hold them in utter disdain, but the people who probably they are of most interest in are those officers involved in the investigative and intelligence work from the Crime Operations Department. Well, those names have all now just been given out to the dissidents, in effect. And so I think what may happen, and I sincerely hope I'm wrong, is that it will simply fan the flames of their ability to do harm to those officers, because some of the groundwork that they would have otherwise have had to have done has just been done for them. So it may be to show that they are a capable and emerging threat, which has the effect of drawing more supporters in to their organization, is they, you know, you may see you know, some terrorism related activity against those officers. And of course, the easiest thing then is to do is to say that, you know, this was enabled by this data breach. And that will have that kind of spiral effect of telling officers, you know, well, you know, your life has been made more difficult because of your own organization. Now, God forbid, John, but if any of those were to be, inverted commas, successful, then those successes tends to draw in more people, more supporters. Whereas of late, what has been happening is that the dissident Republicans have been seen to be at times quite inept, still dangerous, but at times quite inept, and that has kind of forced people to say, well, look, why would I want to join you? Every time you try to do something, you get caught, or there's an informant in your ranks, or your information is wrong, or whatever has happened. But this data breach simply makes their targeting ability much more easy, much more complete, much more advanced, and it wouldn't take an awful lot to have, you know, even a small number of terrorist attacks to just kind of reinvigorate the sense that, you know, you'll understand why I say this, but we haven't gone away.
Roy McComb, thank you so much for joining me on The Dark State. I'll be broadcasting more podcasts on this issue this week. Until we speak again, do take care.